Welcome to Asia Calling, your window on Asia. Coming up on the show this week, a law school for rebels and ethnic minorities in Myanmar's Kachin state. In Pakistan, the fallout from the Panama Papers continues after a Supreme Court verdict ordered a new investigation into the money trail surrounding the Prime Minister and his family. And in India, street kids speak out. Thanks for tuning into the show. I'm Nicole Kirby. Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has survived a Supreme Court case, corruption allegations, and the threat of immediate disqualification from office. But last month's court judgment opened with a quote from the novel The Godfather. "Behind every great fortune, there is a crime." Even though the Prime Minister is celebrating, the verdict hasn't entirely cleared his name, and the controversy is far from over. Asia Calling correspondent Naeem Sahutra reports from Karachi.
Supporters of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif were dancing with joy on streets across Pakistan last month. On April 20th, the Supreme Court ruled by a slim majority that there was insufficient evidence of corruption to dismiss the Prime Minister from the office. The Prime Minister's supporters are claiming victory. Kulsoom Bibi is a member of the PM's party, Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, or PMLN.
Today's Supreme Court verdict has met our hopes. And Imran Khan, you should weep. This is your destiny.
Imran Khan, cricketer turned politician and chairman of the opposition party, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, or PTI, led the court case against the PM. Over 3 months, the court investigated evidence of corruption, first revealed in the Panama Papers last year. The papers suggest that Sharif profited from his position as Prime Minister when he held the office in the 1990s. They show that his three children owned offshore companies that were used to acquire foreign assets, including apartments in Mayfair, London, and that the assets were not declared and were used to avoid paying tax. Imran Khan said the court verdict isn't a clear win for the PM.
Or those Supreme Court ke chief justices, jo future chief,
two of the senior judges, who are the future chief justices of Pakistan, have ruled immediate disqualification of the PM because he was dishonest to the nation.
In its split judgment, two of five judges declared the PM dishonest to the nation and the parliament. They recommended he should be disqualified from office for lying about offshore companies and wealth of his children. But the three remaining judges concluded that the PM retain office, ordering an investigation into Sharif, his family, and the money trail surrounding them to be carried out within just 2 months. Sharif survived immediate disqualification, but the opposition believes he has lost the moral mandate to govern and is demanding his resignation. Opposition leader Imran Khan again.
This is a historic judgment in Pakistan's history against a sitting prime minister. All five judges have ruled that whatever explanation he gave for the source of his income and the money trails running him, it has been rejected.
It's not illegal to hold offshore accounts, but it is illegal to use them for tax evasion and for the Prime Minister to leave wealth and assets undeclared. The forthcoming investigation should establish whether Sharif's three children, Mariam, Hassan and Hussain Nawaz, owned offshore companies in British Virgin Islands and stashed wealth in Panama in order to avoid taxation. But former President Asif Ali Zardari is skeptical that a further investigation will change matters.
I condemn the mockery that's been made of the nation over the last 9 months to a year. I also condemn this judgment. It's a joke. What can the 19 investigating officers do that the Supreme Court could not do? Will they investigate and disqualify this prime minister?
Around 60% of Pakistanis live below the poverty line. Corruption remains rampant in the country. According to Pakistan's National Accountability Bureau, the wealthy illegally send more than $5 million abroad each year. Allegations of corruption have surrounded Nawaz Sharif's family for decades, but the government argues that such allegations are politically motivated. State Minister for Information Maryam Aurangzeb told the media this.
The PM calmly faced the allegation against him and set a history precedent as he presented three generations of his family, his late father, his children and himself before the court of accountability.
Meanwhile, Sharif's daughter, politician Maryam Nawaz, has taken to Twitter, calling the Panama Papers crap and saying they were trashed in the rest of the world. The Panama Papers have led to nearly 150 investigations, audits, prosecutions and arrests in almost 80 countries around the world over the last year. As the investigation team prepares to probe a financial controversy spanning several decades in just 2 months, the government is working on its image for the next elections in a year's time. For Asia Calling, this is Naeem Sohotra in Karachi, Pakistan.
In Myanmar, the army and ethnic minorities have been fighting since the 1960s in what is the world's longest-running civil war. Hundreds of thousands have been killed. Millions have fled their homes and live in camps for refugees and internally displaced people. Serious human rights violations continue. But amidst the violence and setbacks, one initiative is preparing minority groups for a peaceful struggle. In Kachin State, northern Myanmar, Kanika Pechkau met with the founder and students of the country's first law school for ethnic minorities.
In the remote area along Myanmar's border with China sits the town of Maijiang. It's quiet and eerie. Most shops and houses are abandoned. Mortar shelling can be heard in the distance. Many residents fled to safer places years ago. For those who choose to stay in Maijiang, like lawyer Ong Tu, life is risky.
Like military towns. It means that they are going to bomb us at any time.
Maijiang is the largest town in area controlled by the Kachin Independence Organization, or KIO, a resistance group that has been fighting for self-government since 1962. 3 years ago, KIO named the town of Maijiang an education hub for ethnic minorities. Since then, schools and colleges have sprung up. Half of the town's population is now students. Hundreds have moved from surrounding areas in northern Myanmar to study.
The students and all the leaders of society need to understand what is the relation between law and society.
After decades of struggle against the military regime, pushing for human rights, and working with ethnic minorities, prominent lawyer Ong Tu established a law school for minorities in Maijiang in 2014.
And they intend to study law.
That's right.
They really
That's
want
right.
to.
That's right. Okay. Only then they will come here because it is very remote and rather dangerous.
Right. With fighting close and the risk of attack higher, evacuation procedures at the school are practiced regularly. Books and computers are packed each day, ready for a quick escape. With 100 students, Federal Law Academy is Myanmar's first ever law school for ethnic minorities. Throughout 60 years of civil war, minority groups have had their rights to citizenship, education, and movement restricted. Without knowledge of the law, Ong Tu says, they have been unable to defend themselves legally, and they cannot rely on others.
There has been no single ethnic lawyers. All of those who are very famous and all of those who are successful, they are not interested in protecting the rights of the other nationalities.
Until now, all of Myanmar's law schools were in Yangon. But ethnic minority groups rarely have access to Yangon, which is a long and expensive trip from their homes. And on top of that, institutions in Yangon discriminate against minority groups, rarely accepting their applications. 25-year-old Toure, an ethnic Koreni, traveled 2 days from his home on the Thai-Myanmar border to study at the Federal Law Academy.
In our state, there are no law schools, so my organization sent us to study here.
The Koreni National Progressive Party, an arms group fighting against the government along the Myanmar-Thai border, sponsored his education. Toure hopes that his education can be part of a peaceful solution to a conflict that is twice as old as he is. The first students graduated from Federal Law Academy last year.
In the past, I learned from the Myanmar government university.
Among them was 24-year-old Lapai No San from the Kachin ethnic group, who along with other graduates runs workshops on human rights and the rule of law.
We need to share information, the federalism, to other people. So I have done some training.
Their workshops discuss how federal system worked in other parts of the world and how the system could be applied in Myanmar. Minorities hope for decentralization in Myanmar, where power would be transferred from a strong central government to local authorities, giving ethnic minorities the autonomy they have spent decades fighting for.
They should be qualified to establish their own federal union with their own legal capacities.
Ong Tu says the law school aims to prepare minority groups to participate in drafting and implementing laws and constitutions in federal union. He hopes that his students, who have long lived in war zones, will one day work as lawyers in a unified Myanmar.
So that they can continue the process for the establishment of the genuine federal union to change the history of our country.
For Asia Calling, this is Kanika Petkao from northern Myanmar.
You're listening to Asia Calling KBR. Around the world, there are 150 million children eking out a living on streets, selling things, working and scavenging. And while street kids are visible in many major cities of the world, their voices are rarely heard. But on International Day for Street Children last month, a special event in India's capital gave street kids the opportunity to tell their stories for themselves. From New Delhi, Jasvinder Sagal has this story.
For one day last week, New Delhi's cultural hub, the India Islamic Cultural Centre, was overrun with hundreds of children. Kids were dressed in the best clothes they could muster, songs from famous Hindi films played, and children took centre stage. 18-year-old Chandani was MC. She told the audience that after the death of her father, she sold flowers at traffic lights to earn money. Today, she says, other kids have the opportunity to share their experiences of living and working on the streets.
The sole objective of organizing this program is so that street children can talk about the various issues they face in their own voice. Nobody is ready to listen to street children and working children. We just want to give their voice a platform so that their issues can be approached with positive thinking.
The event Street Talk was organized by NGO Childhood Enhancement Through Training and Action, or Chetana. Head of the NGO Sanjay Gupta said that a proactive approach could reduce the number of children living on the street.
10 selected children are sharing their life journey. And through this, we are wanting to convey that there are certain very small things which children are suffer with. If we take the action in time, probably we will not have issue of street children.
16-year-old Akhilesh Hussain was forced to share his story, and it was met with plenty of applause from a captivated audience. As a child, Akhilesh was persuaded to leave home with his uncle in search of work. Abandoned by his uncle in New Delhi, he told me he was left penniless.
I met a lady who took me in. Initially, she was very caring and good. But after a while, she forced me to beg and earn money for her.
Eventually, Akhilesh got help from an NGO working for the rights of children, and he was able to trace his parents.
These days, I'm not begging on the street. I'm studying, and in my free time, I sell soft drinks. The money I earn is enough to pay for my education, clothes and boarding and lodging. I want to do a course in cell phone repairing so that my future is safe.
₹18 million children walk on the streets of India. Many are homeless and disconnected from their families. They are often chased from their homes because of violence, drug and alcohol abuse or poverty. The work is usually illegal, leaving them vulnerable to abuse, exploitation, and poor working conditions. 16-year-old Poonam has been working since she was 5 years old, supporting her five siblings. She told me she is no stranger to poor working conditions.
At the age my parents started school, I started work. I used to make a jewelry with a sharp edge knife that often pierced my palm. People I worked with got tetanus. Later, I made shoes using long needles and scissors. I cut myself many times. We couldn't afford a doctor, so instead my mother put herbs on my wounds.
As the program wrapped up, Chandani called on participants to raise their voices against exploitation of all kinds. For 14-year-old Tanzeem, who sells balloons by the roadside, the stories he heard left an impression, and he says his sights are now set on the highest office in the country.
I came to hear the experiences of my fellow children. I've learned many things from this program. It has motivated me to be like Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who was once a street child selling tea. I have heard him a lot and I want to become like him.
For Asia Calling, this is Jaswinder Sehgal in New Delhi, India.
As a guerrilla fighter, 61-year-old Madalena Suarez fought long and hard for the independence of Timor-Leste, the tiny half-island nation that was formerly occupied by Indonesia. And her bravery has not gone unnoticed. Suarez received an End Peace Award from the United Nations Development Programme in 2013. And since then, she's become an inspiring role model for women in Timor-Leste. Reporter Teodesia Dosares has this report.
I met Madalena in her village not far from the capital, Dili. The 61-year-old is also known by her code name Kasian. In the local language, Tetum, that means poor. But it had a double meaning for Madalena. As a guerrilla fighter, it referred both to how the Timorese was poorly equipped to fight against Indonesia, and also poor Madalena, who had to leave her family to go fight soldiers in the jungle. During the fight for independence, Madalena was a soldier for Falantil, the military of Timor-Leste. Here, she is explaining what it was like.
I'm a guerrilla dead, I'm a siguranza ho kilat.
We were guerrilla fighters with the men, with weapons in our hands. At night, we tried to block off the enemy. When we fought against the Indonesian military, us women were ready. And when the Indonesian soldiers were shot, we would go and take the weapons.
Madalena says
she didn't hesitate to join the guerrilla fighters. She was one of about 20 Timorese women that took up arms to fight for independence.
At the time, I was with the male soldiers. I fought like men because I didn't want my life to be tortured by the Indonesian military.
But these days, Madalena has picked a different fight. After Timor-Leste gained independence from Indonesia in 1999, Madalena decided to contribute to her new nation in a different way. Over the years, she built 5 kindergartens to help young Timorese children get an education. More than 30 children under the age of 6 attend the kindergartens before they go to primary school. Madalena says their kindergarten are part of an ongoing commitment to the country.
The struggle for independence was more than 24 years ago, but I intend to keep contributing to the development of the country. That's why I founded the schools, so that in the future the young generation will remember our struggle for the country's freedom and development.
Madalena funds the kindergartens with her modest veterans pension. Illiterate herself, education, she says, is the key to the country's development. And if she isn't busy enough, Madalena also helps to create employment for women in Timor through an organization called Falukadomi Timor for the widows in the former combatants. They make and sell tais, a traditional form of weaving in Timor that they turn into bags and wallets and other goods sold at the tourist markets.
I founded the organization and involved my friends to produce the handicrafts in order to gain money for our daily needs. I always motivate them so they can do it on their own without being dependent to others.
A national hero and an inspiring peace activist, Madalena has long been committed to Timor-Leste. For Asia Calling KBR, this report was produced by Theodesia Dos Reis in Dili, Timor-Leste.
That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced in the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling for more updates. You can now also podcast the show. Go to the iTunes Store or your podcasting app and search for Asia Calling and subscribe for free to the weekly episodes. I'm Nicole Kirby, back next week with more stories from Asia.
Think what was good. I think I might be late.